Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Resilient Relationships Talk Show, our very first episode.
My name is Dr. Christian Heim.
And my name is Dr. Caroline Heim.
And I'm from Sydney, Australia. That's good. I'm a clinical psychiatrist.
And I'm an associate professor at a university.
But in a former life, I was a classical musician.
And in a former life, I was a New York actor.
And together, we have been married for over 30 years, but for this talk show, we're bringing together our expertise, our experiences, and our research to bring you a show so that your relationship can stay together longer and stronger.
That's right. That's what it's all about. And it's actually based on a study. All our research that we'll be sharing on this talk show is based on a study that we did that we've just finished that is the largest cross-sectional study on long-term relationships to date.
To date, yes. And look, this study and this research, which we've been engaged in for quite some years now, has spawned books and journal articles and lectures, and now this talk show to bring it out in the world, because this world needs to know how to keep relationships together.
That's right. So who's our audience, though, for this?
Who is our audience? Well, our audience at the moment is whoever is out there. Thank you for joining
us.
Yes,
thank you. It's you.
It's you. It definitely is you. So primarily, this is for people who choose to be in a long-term relationship, are finding that, you know, being in a long-term relationship is difficult. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Yes.
You know, yes, you have. Okay, good. So it's to give techniques for people who are in a long-term relationship, but it's also for people who have been in a long-term relationship for a long time and they just want to keep it going. It's also for people who are thinking of being in a long-term relationship, are looking for a long-term relationship. And Caroline, they've got to know what they're in for, because it takes effort before the reward. But the good news is, if you put in the effort, you get the reward.
Well, as some of our couples said that we interviewed for our study, it's damn hard work.
Yes.
But there's gold at the end. Well, actually, there's gold all the way through.
So the gold comes with the effort.
Yeah.
But we're in a society that lets you think that you can have things easily, that you can have things without effort. And that just is not true. So we've got to get through some of the lies of our society to get to the truth and the evidence of what it takes to keep a relationship together.
That's right. And it is actually all in the evidence. That's the most important thing. So each week we're going to be giving you a little bit of science. We're going to be giving you a bit of application of the science. And then we are also going to be giving you some stories. So do you want to talk to the science a little bit, Christian?
Okay. So as a loose structure, we're going to look at science because, as researchers, we are scientists.
Yeah.
Okay, now doctors aren't quite scientists, but what we do is based on science, and you in the humanities also need science as a body of knowledge to keep things together. So where do we get to know the science? We get to know the science mainly through journals, where we get to publish what we have found in our research, but we will also be looking at other journal articles of what other people have researched and what their findings are. So the other thing about the science is it's our best shot of knowing what reality actually is. So we're going to put a lot of emphasis on the science, okay? Because science is also something that everybody in the world can agree on. Whatever our beliefs are, whatever our diversity is, science says, no, this is the closest that we can get to objectivity. So another thing about the science is I like to take you inside the brain, because in the last 25 years in particular, we have found out a lot about how the brain works. And a lot of the brain is still a mystery, but there's a lot that we know. And it is just fascinating to see what happens when two people come into relationship and live together day in, day out. What happens is they affect each other's brains quite deeply and change each other's brains and mold so that the brains grow closer together if the relationship is working well. So I like to describe how that actually happens and what we know of the science of what's going on in the brain in two people who are in close relationship.
And this comes from your psychiatric background, studying the brain, and it's actually really exciting stuff to actually see how the brain works and also how that works for couples to keep couples together. And the facts are out there. The facts are out there in the journal articles and even in the science in the brain.
In fact, this is one of of the exciting things about being alive in human history right now. We have so much information, so much good information, that we do have answers out there. The thing is that perhaps we've got too much information and we've got to wade through what is good information and what is not so good information, which is why we've got this emphasis on science, because the information is the best that we can actually have. So that's the science.
That's the science. Okay, then. That's great, but we do need to apply it because they're facts. Yes, it's very interesting and everything, but how do we apply it? That's why we've got the application section.
So every week we'll be looking at applying the science. And, you know, it's not easy. This is actually where we all fall down. This is what you need to do, but you sort of go, well, how is that going to show up in my life? Okay, so let's take something like commitment, which we know is scientifically is something that is needed for a good long-term relationship. Mm. How do I get that working in my life? Because we know that commitment is not just a one day when you said, I do, and that's enough. So what do I got to do? Have I got to wake up every morning and say that I'm committed? No. But we've got to look at how people actually show their commitment, to show their love to their partner. And this is the application, getting it actually working in your life. And this is where we've got to interpret the science and we've got to modify it so that it works for different people in different situations so that they can get this thing happening, which is making relationships longer and stronger. And that's what this talk show is all about.
Yeah, and you talked about that word commitment.
I did.
Ouch. This is a big talking point and we will be coming back to it a lot because, the media's got a lot to say about it. We've got a lot to say about it. Our results have a lot to say about it. We've got some great stories about commitment and what it means and what it can mean from you and some really great techniques even on how to, you know, apply some of the science to your life.
Well, okay, so that's like the third part of what we'll be doing in these talk shows. We'll be looking at techniques and we'll be looking at stories. Because the brain actually works in stories, and I'm going back to the science here, but stories are becoming very important because stories unite us as human beings.
Yeah.
They also separate us as individuals, and there's a big tension between what individuals want and their journeys and what the meta story, so in other words, the whole cultural story of our society is. And we have to be a part of that because if we lose that, then we can actually lose civilization. So there's a tension between the individual and society, and it's united in stories because in a very deep sense, a person's individual story reflects the whole story of humankind. So,
you throw these things out there,
do,
and I'm just going to have to get you to explain that a little bit more.
Okay, so in our society today, we talk a lot about diversity and the importance of the individual, and so we're emphasizing how different we are as people. But the question is, how different are we really? Because we all are born, we have to develop as children, then we have to contribute as adults, and we have to reproduce for the whole of the human race to keep going, and then we all die. And in that, there's a common story. There's a story that is common to us all. So although we'll be using individual stories, we'll also be looking at this common story that we all live, develop, reproduce, and die. And how that contributes to the whole, because we are all contributing to society.
Yeah, okay. That's really interesting. So we'll be really interested in your stories and how you can apply this to your story, your relationship story, your life story. Talking about stories, I think, well, for this episode anyway, we're going to obviously give you some of the background of the research that we've of our big study and some of the great findings that we've got, just as a bit of a teaser and also a bit of an overview of our research. But we're going to start off with our stories. So Christian.
Okay, yeah. So we're going to talk about our stories because who are we?
Who are we to put on this talk show?
Yes, I've asked myself that question all my life.
It's an important question to ask.
It is, actually. It is. Maybe the problem comes when you get the answers, you know.
Anyway. Or if you get stuck in those answers, you know, if you don't keep searching and, that's more of an issue. Anyway, your story, Christian.
So I will. I'll share a story that has to do with how I got involved in relationships and researching relationships. So as I mentioned earlier, I'm a clinical psychiatrist, and to become a clinical psychiatrist, first you have to study as a medical student. You become a doctor, you work as a doctor for several years in a hospital, before you then decide where you're going to specialize. And I specialized in psychiatry, and I love it because I get to hear the stories of so many people. I get to hear a lot of sad stories, and that does take its toll.
Yeah.
But I attended a lecture, almost 20 years ago now, that basically said, look, it's not enough to treat people with mental illness, because the way society is heading, we have to find ways of preventing mental illness in the first place so that people don't have all these problems like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, anorexia, post-traumatic stress disorder, addictions, and more. Mm. So I started looking at what are the factors that will help people keep their mental health. So through all of this, one of the things that I discovered, one of the strongest things that help people keep their mental health is relationships in their life. So good relationships with parents, good relationships with family members, with friends, but the most important relationship is actually with your love partner, the person that you will be romantically involved in. And 99% of the human race go through attached to somebody in their life.
99%?
Yeah, it's only... okay, so those studies come from how many people will go through life without being sexually attached to anybody.
Oh, okay.
And it's less than 1%. So in other words, it is part of our DNA, it is part of our human life experience that we attach closely and intimately to another person.
Mm.
So that doesn't mean that that's how many people get married, but that's how many people are attached in some way to another person. Okay, so it's rare to be unattached, except in today's society. So that brings out a whole other thing. Anyway, I'll
leave that one. You're digressing.
I'm digressing.
That's for another talk show. Yeah.
Okay, so I will do that some other time. But in that, I also found that in my clinical work, I was working a lot with people who had post-traumatic stress disorder, and they received that diagnosis after serving in a war. And these people, men predominantly, would have a lot of problems. There'd be a lot of things that we'd have to get on top of. Alcoholism, violence, nightmares, anxiety, fears, shaking, a startle response that is heightened. But one of their big problems was often that they would be in a relationship that was tenuous. It would be fragile. I'm about to lose my relationship. So one of the things that I did was I would work on the relationship early on. Now, okay, I would refer these people to psychologists to say, could you please take care of this person's relationship while I take care of their PTSD?
Mm.
And the responses that I got back was, yes, I'd be glad to take care of this person's relationship, but please cure their PTSD first. And I knew their relationship would be over long before I could do that. So I would start working on it myself.
Okay.
So in other words, I did a lot of couples therapy as part of my work on PTSD. And I got interested in couples therapy. Through that, I became a specialist in couples therapy when mental illness was part of the clinical picture. And through that, I was able to hear a lot of relationship stories. I was able to work with a lot of couples. Sometimes I'd work individually. Sometimes I'd work with the couple. Whatever could be done to save the relationship, I actually did. Mm. Then I got some formal training in couples therapy, and I kept specializing in couples therapy when mental illness was part of the problem. And that, as you know, took us to the Resilient Relationship Project that we are a part of, that we undertook to see what it was about good relationships. What is it that people who have been in relationship over 40 years have, so that the people that I worked with knew what to aim for? So what we did in that study was to look at what works, and in my practice, I could then work with people so that they could aim for something good rather than avoid the bad in relationships.
That's really good. So I don't think you're really clear enough about the association between preventative mental health and relationships. Can you just speak to that a little bit more?
Okay, thanks for that, Caroline. Yeah. So we are going through a mental health crisis in our community at the moment, and there are too many people experiencing too many mental health problems. So the thing about it is, if we could find ways to stop people get mental illness in the first place, that would be better. So I undertook a research project into what are the factors that actually help prevent people getting mental illness. And this is actually really quite difficult because there are a few things in society. For example, social media is something that is actually causing or leading to mental health problems. Okay, it's a contributing factor. And so that's one thing that I work with in the work that I do. But the primary thing was actually people's relationships. And so the technical term for it is actually attachment. Mm-hmm. Our attachment to other human beings is vitally important. It is a biological necessity that we attach to other people. So, okay, fundamentally, an infant, a newborn infant, could not survive without a mother or a caring figure. So right there, we see that there is a biological need for us to be in relationship. The thing is that we take our relationships with our mother or a parent figure for granted. And because we take it for granted, we underestimate how important relationships are for all of us from the cradle to the grave, as the theorist and psychiatrist John Bowlby would say. Because our relationships, our attachments are important not only as children and infants, but as adults as well. So the whole theory, which we'll go into in another talk show, is that our adult attachments are as important, although different, to our attachment to our mother.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the basis of a lot of couples therapy at the moment, to use the theory of attachment to help prevent mental illness. Because here's the equation. If we are securely attached in our relationships, that makes us more resilient, which leads to less mental illness in the community. So that's how being in relationship and being well attached in a good relationship leads to less mental illness, which is why I personally think if I spend more time researching in this area, that means that we can lead to a situation where less people end up with mental illness in the first place. And that's part of why we're doing this talk show, Caroline.
That's right. And you've just explained how it ties to resilience and how being attached to someone, just like a mother and a child, strengthens the actual person. So individually through attachment, and therefore makes them resilient, gives them more strength to be able to cope with whatever life throws at them. But if they're having to cope alone, it's pretty tough.
It's and we have a lot of studies which we will mention. So, and the famous one is that a divorced male is six times more likely to take his own life than a married male.
Yeah.
So that shows the protective nature of being in a good relationship.
That's the whole thing too, the protectiveness of it.
The protectiveness of it.
So it's preventative and protective.
Protective and preventative are almost synonymous in that context. Okay, so that says a lot about my story or something. But the big question is, how is it that a theatre academic is working in the area of relationships, Caroline?
Yes, well, my story isn't quite as long as Christian's because he's a psychiatrist and he was in this field a long, long time before I was. But we didn't share at the beginning that I actually am a theatre academic. So I have the theatre background. I did the acting. We said I was an associate professor, but I am an associate professor of theatre. So, how did I get in, you know, that I teach acting, I teach theatre history, and I'm in the humanities. How did I get involved in relationships? Well, the real first insight I want to give you into that is that theatre is all about relationships. It is all about relationships, the drama of relationships in the plays and everything, but relationships between characters on stage, relationships in the theatre, between actors and audience members. It's all about relationships. It tells the stories of our lives, and it gets the relationships from life and puts them on stage and says, oh, this is what's going on. So it really documents how relationships change and evolve over history. And, you know, when the divorce laws came in, there were plays about divorce. When women, you know, got the vote, there were plays about that. It's very, very much about the roles that we play in life and primarily about relationships. So that's just the starting point for why I'm involved in relationships. The second point is that I am an author and I do a lot of academic writing in my job, and I've written two books, and the books are primarily about the relationships in theatre. So I have written books about actors and audience members. I've had the opportunity to travel all over the world, and I've interviewed over 200 actors and audience members all over the world from many different countries. And during that time of writing these books, and I was writing about the psychology of relationships in those books, I developed a very innovative methodology for interviewing people.
And I found that when I started researching in the area of couples and relationships, that I needed a good methodology that would work for the interviews that needed to be done there. And I could go to nobody better than you. So could you tell us about that methodology? What actually is about it that is good for couple relationships and finding information in that area?
Well, what's really interesting about the methodology, it's very other-driven. So it's couple-driven. It's normally when, you know, someone interviews, there's always the expert that's interviewing and yes, knows all about the field, and they add their expertise. But we actually, when I did this in my own research, I privileged the actors as the experts, yes, the audience members as the experts, and wrote down what their experience was instead of adding my own or directing the questions so much. I let the actors and audiences members speak about their stories, if you like, and theatre is definitely about storytelling. So, because I wanted to capture their stories, because that's where the gold is. And then when we applied that to couple research, because Christian came and asked me and said, can we do this study? Can you apply your methodology to the study we want to do and to couples? It became about the couple's stories. And I really privileging their voice as experts and journeying with them, and that's where, again, we got the gold from that kind of research.
Yes, it was, because most of the work in this area, so I'm going back to the science,
yeah,
is based on what couples need to avoid so that they don't fall apart.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of research that says the bad things that contribute to divorce.
Yeah.
But what we wanted to do was look at the good things that contribute to long-term relationships.
Yeah.
And so to do that, I needed your methodology that would, as you say, privilege the couple voice. So in other words, make couples the expert to say, could you please tell us what actually leads to a good relationship?
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of the research out there on long-term relationships looks at, oh, this went wrong and this caused divorce, which is a pathogenic approach. But we wanted to do what's called a salutogenic approach, which is to look at what went right in relationships. How did they survive? They went through things too that helped, you know, that could have caused a breakup. But we wanted to see how they got through it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, good.
So that's how I got involved in all of that.
Okay, and the other thing is that we saw together, because we are married after all.
We are.
Is that we saw that we are now living in a society that is not supporting relationships.
So true.
To the point where people didn't know what it takes to have a long-term relationship. And we were actually concerned that people around us or people in our society that we saw had good relationships and had relationships that lasted 40, 50 years would not be with us for too long.
That's right.
Because generations die out. And if they die out, then the information about what makes a good relationship would die out with them.
That's exactly right. They have so much wisdom and insight. Right. And we saw it all around us. I mean, you probably have, you know, grandparents or anything, people that in your life, that are older adults that speak into your life in some way. And there's so much wisdom in the couple area that we wanted to capture, and their stories too, to put into our research.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, they have the secrets.
That's right. They have the secrets. And it's kind of something that we say often, that young people stare up at their grandparents to say, how did you stay together for 50 years when I'm struggling in my relationship after 50 days?
And yeah, and I even find that with my students, know, because they have to portray relationships on stage since theatre is all about relationship.
Yes.
And they struggle with it because they're very much in an individual world, you know, and it's all about them quite often. Well, it's not necessarily all about them. They're told by the media it's all about them.
Yeah.
But they need to learn how to be in relationship. And so, yeah, and my students have so many mental health issues. It's a salutogenic approach. Let's not look at all the problems. Let's look at what can go right.
Yes, yes. But just while we're on your students, because we treasure your students, we see their journeys, we see their struggles.
Yeah.
And what you share with me about your students keeps me in line with what young adults are struggling with in today's society.
Yeah.
And part of the approach was we asked young adults what they wanted to know about their relationships and if they had the opportunity to ask a couple that had been together 40, 50 years, what would it be? And this is what gave us a lot of hope, that that young adults actually want their relationships to last. So that's what our research is actually about.
Yeah, so we're getting into the research now. We're starting to talk about the main research.
About that. Yes,
yeah, so that was the starting point. We wanted to ask people, 290 young people actually, what was it? What do you want to ask people that are married 40 plus years? If you had one burning question, what would it be? And then we went and we asked, 932 coupled individuals, what their answer to those questions were. That was the whole premise of the study.
Okay, so what we did in this study is create an intergenerational discourse. We had the opportunity to ask young couples, what do you want to know?
Yeah.
And we got their top five questions.
Yes.
But their overwhelming top question was, how do you do it? How do you keep it together? What's your secret? Can we keep a relationship together as long as you have?
Yeah, what's your glue?
And that,
I mean, some of them even said, like, how is it even possible? I can't see how you can, you know, keep on going for that long. How do you do it? This is incomprehensible to some of them. And it really was one of the most overwhelming results in the book, that's the number one question that
they
wanted.
Right.
So actually said, yes, these young people do actually want long-term relationships.
Okay, so right there we've got to confront something in society, because there is a narrative which is projected by the media that people want to go from relationship to relationship, or we're looking at alternative frameworks of relationships. And there are alternative frameworks of relationships, but overwhelmingly, people want to have one relationship. They just don't know how to do it in the pressures of today's society. That's what our evidence shows.
Yes.
And so we put that question, as you said, to the couples. And the number one finding that we found was, look, you've got to be committed. It takes commitment.
Yeah.
That was the number one.
There was quite a few findings, but we had a top three. Of findings for what the older couples told us. So the number one was commitment.
Okay. So let's just go into something that Caroline picked up on right there, that I mentioned the top finding, but Caroline mentioned that we have a diversity. Mm. Okay, and that's actually quite important in itself, because what the we have articulated, what was it, 17 findings, which means that different things work for different people. And that's actually important in a society that we're in at the moment, because there is room for diversity. However, we also found that the top three findings accounted for more than a third of all people's ideas of what it takes to have a long-term relationship.
The secrets, yeah. The secrets, that's right, yeah. And I mean, this we did have diversity.
Yes,
and
we
had we interviewed people from 52 different countries all over the world. Yeah. So
how many people?
Over 1,400 altogether, including the young people.
Yep.
Yeah, so 932 coupled individuals, either in interviews. So there was 180 coupled individuals in interviews, so 90 couples I interviewed.
Yes.
And then we surveyed, it was 932, I believe, altogether. So... So we have a really robust study here with some really fantastic results. Obviously, we asked them lots of questions, but this was the primary question that we ended up asking.
It was, and we will be unpacking this through these talk shows. But the top three findings were commitment, altruism, and shared values.
Yeah.
And in our book, Resilient Relationships, we talk about the theory of how those three things fundamentally affect our attachment to our adult love partner.
Yeah.
So in other words, they are actually part of what I call that story, that narrative that is common to all of us. So even though there's individual variation, which we did find, there is still a core of these are the things that would help each and every relationship.
Yeah, and they're really great findings because they do actually tie in with the literature. So we obviously did a literature review for the book, and over the past 100 years, there hasn't actually been many studies on long-term relationships.
Yeah.
There really haven't. And it's a real gap in the knowledge. There's always these interesting areas that couples researchers look at, but they don't actually look so much at the glue, the secrets.
Yep.
Only a handful of papers. So the first one was about 1938, actually, was looking at what makes couples happy, whereas we were looking at really what is their secret for longevity. So we're really looking at relationship longevity. And the last significant study was actually in 1998 of a size similar to ours. But again, that was just surveys. But there were some really robust findings. But the interesting thing about the word commitment is that that did come up quite regularly in most of the studies.
It did in most of the studies, but it became prominent from the 1980s.
Yeah.
And I want to speak to that because we're going to talk about the context of our study, because context is actually very, very important. So as we all know, marriage has been in decline. Divorce has been on the increase, and there's been a few factors, and we talk about this in the book, how in the 1960s, the advent of the pill means that we could uncouple relationship with sexual activity, and because of that, relationships were, I won't say devalued, but it became less of a necessity to be in a committed long-term relationship to experience sex. The second thing that happened was the relaxed divorce laws, which happened throughout the world, starting in the mid-70s towards the mid-80s, when, let's say, California was the first to pass laws on no-fault divorce. So if you just wanted a divorce, that's fine. We can actually do that. And there is actually an advantage when there are relaxed divorce laws. It means that unhappy married couples can actually divorce, which means that the people who choose to stay married today are actually happier.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So it's not all doom and
gloom.
No,
absolutely not. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
However, through the 70s and the 80s, and it peaked in the 90s, divorce was actually increasing, okay, because it was able to be done. People did that. So in that context comes this study that showed that commitment was really quite important. And,
there was actually three or four studies during that time, in the 80s and the 90s. That was the peak of all the studies.
That was the peak of all the studies, and it culminated in the study of 1998 that showed that commitment was the number one thing.
Mm.
But it would be when you're surveying people who can see that divorce is now easy thanks to the laws, and they decide that you need to have commitment.
Yeah.
And it's true. It's a true and robust finding, and you do need to have that commitment because it's part of the definition of being in a relationship as well.
Yeah.
What I'm interested in is the prominence in our study the first in 25 years in that area, that found the prominence of altruism.
Yeah.
Of having to be able to take care of somebody else, to get out of yourself, to be there for somebody else. And one of the things that I want to say about that comes in response to the context, to the society that we find ourselves in, and a lot of people seeing that we now live in a society that is so for itself, so for individualism, that makes it very difficult to have relationships.
Yes, and because of this finding, and this is where we really need to, we haven't actually told them the title of the book.
Okay, let's
we need to look at the, because we did contextualize the research in what's happening in society today in this 21st century. So the book is called Resilient Relationships, Techniques for Surviving Hyper-Individualism, Social Isolation and a Mental Health Crisis. So the first part of the book looks at that contextuality, the hyper-individualism, social isolation and mental health crisis. The second part looks at the results of the study, and the third part gives techniques. So,
okay, so I'm just going to repeat all of that because it's actually quite a mouthful.
It is.
As you found.
Yes.
So from the title of the book, which is Resilient Relationships, because that's really what we're about, resilience, and we're going to have to talk about that in some talk shows.
Yes.
Relationships, we're going to have to talk about that in some
talk shows.
But the title is Resilient Relationships, Surviving Hyper-Individualism, Social Isolation and a Mental Health Crisis, Techniques for Surviving Hyper-individualism, socialization, and a mental health crisis. So the second part of that title is the context that we find ourselves in.
That's right. And so, you were already starting to talk about it
a little bit. Yeah.
So why hyper-individualism?
All right. So let's talk about hyper-individualism because it's a term that not everybody is familiar with, and yet it's a term that gets talked about a lot. And I talked about how in our society we live in a very me-focused time, that I as an individual am very important. Now, individualism, especially in the United States, has been growing for a couple of centuries now. So that means rather than being a culture that concentrates on the collective human experience, the point of the individual in that collective experience becomes more and more important. And so we see this in, let's say, movies. Okay, part of our culture is the movies, and we find a hero, somebody who is making it and succeeding on their own as an individual. So even all the big movies like...
The Marvel movies. Yeah.
Armageddon, the Lord of the Rings trilogy. You see a couple of individuals that shine through. And this is part of the ideal in our culture, which is fine. That's individualism. Hyper-individualism, however, is, by definition, something that goes above, more than, or beyond individualism. So in a sense, it's individualism that says, not only do I want to make it, but I'm more important than the whole society. Me first, everybody else second. So one definition of hyper-individualism includes the idea of living your life as a conscious and judged self-made life project. So you've got to be the author of your life. You've got to do what you want, and your life is what you make it. Now, here's the interesting thing about hyper-individualism. That all sounds good. More fun for me, more of me, and for me to be successful. But if it was so individual driven, why is it that it's accompanied with a lot of mental illness,
yes,
a lot of isolation, and a lot of misery?
And see, this is what I'm seeing in my students. I get things called disability reports. So these are reports that I get when students are going through different issues, physical issues, you know, and that compromises perhaps their work in their assessments. And I have to, you know, take that into consideration and even with their grade. But what I've seen in the last 5 years is an escalation in disability reports on mental health issues, particularly anxiety, depression, and all sorts of different things. But I've seen such an escalation in it, and I've seen students leave the classroom because they're too anxious to work. There's been episodes in you know, even in lectures and in the workshops that I do. And it's part of what they're going through. They're really, really struggling. And, you know, obviously we talk about the mental health issues related with that. I talk about that with Christian at home, and he obviously helps me with some guidance there with that. Because I'm actually having to carry that as well as my teaching, because they're going through so much. And my heart just goes out to them. They're just struggling so hard, some of them, just to survive in this very strongly me-centric society.
Okay, so let me bring some science into the experience of your students.
Great.
Because they're in a hyper-individual society. They're in a society where they have had less attachment to family than anyone throughout history, and they're feeling bad in themselves. And in a hyper-individual society that basically says your happiness is above anything else, a lot of people go for pleasure rather than happiness, because there's a difference between long-term contentment and pleasure. And so when people hear the word happiness and they're feeling bad inside, what happens is they tend to go for short-term pleasures. So what I'm doing is I'm going to addictions to show how that is a manifestation of hyper-individualism.
Okay.
Because what addictions do is they give you a lot of pleasure in a short period of time right now. So addictions stop you feeling bad now. Now, people who get addicted are not people who have character weaknesses, but as the science is showing, they are people who have bad feelings due to bad attachment experiences, and addictions become one solution to a very complex problem. But it's a solution that ends up in more problems, because whenever I have treated people who have addictions, I find a person that has gone for pleasure but ends up in pain.
Mm.
And that is a reflection of hyper-individualism, making yourself the center, trying to alleviate hurt in yourself, which gets done by short-term pleasures like alcohol, cocaine, marijuana, gambling, and all other substances and addictions, but it ends up in more pain. And that's one of the mechanisms that scientifically we know happens in today's society. So the question is not, how do we get people off addictions? The question is, how do we fulfill their attachment needs so that people feel better about themselves?
And that actually brings us up to the second part of the book, which is social isolation, because that's another thing that's there, and mental health issues that are tied in with that.
Yeah, it does. Okay,
yeah.
So social isolation. We live in a world where we are becoming increasingly isolated from each other. And just as a few examples, I suppose a famous example is the COVID crisis that we've been through, where we were actually told to isolate from each other, and we needed to physically distance from each other. In fact, we even used the word social distancing, which was a pity, because you never want to socially distance from anybody. Okay, but there are other things. Households, where it used to be that you would have four or five people living in a household about 100 years ago. Now, let's say in Tokyo, 50% of households have one person living in it.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Which means that we're becoming isolated.
We are.
And that is technically called atomization. But also the amount of conflict in today's society means that we cut off from each other a whole lot more than we actually should.
Mm.
But the big thing is the social media. And something that was supposed to promise us connection has actually given us disconnect. Because if you just imagine a whole group of people in a room together where they would be either playing, arguing, or talking, they now have their eyes on a brick, which is only a few inches from their face, and they are texting, which means that all those people are isolated from themselves.
Oh, it just kills me. I walk into a room and my students, instead of talking with each other, you know, 25 of them, they're all just in front of this, and this is their time. This is their time to build community and to get all those wonderful brain chemicals that you get from being together, you know, and they're just in front of this brick. Mind you, I have a phone-free policy. I say, nope, technology-free in here. 3 hours,
Yes.
No technology. And I even get them to write things in journals. They actually have to hand write in a journal. They scream and they yell and they do all of that. But I make them do that because it just frees their brain. And yes. They can't be as creative either if they're stuck behind that little square.
So one of my favourite pieces of science is by Christian Montag. It is a study that shows that the more time you spend on social media, the smaller your anterior cingulate gyrus, which is a part of your brain which generates empathy for other people, which means that the more time you're on social media, the less empathy you have for other people, the less relationships you have, which means the more time you spend on social media, and we are in a negative, vicious cycle. Anyway, that's something to unpack for future episodes. The other thing about the context is a mental health crisis, which is huge, and I will talk about that some other time. But part two of our book is basically where your focus came in on the interviews with couples.
Yes.
And their experiences and documenting all of our findings.
That's right. So it's been a five-year project, actually. And so we have travelled all around to different places in the world to interview people that have been married 40-plus years. So the interviews, the 90 interviews that I did was actually with people that, you know, had been together with one person. I think the longest was 73 years. I got the privilege that the husband was actually 100 years old. That was very interesting, that interview. It was really a privilege to hear their stories. Again, we go back to stories. They shared stories with me. We laughed together. We cried together. There was some revelations. There was some secrets that hadn't been spoken before, spoken out loud, because they really wanted to help young people with their stories. It was such a privilege to me to walk through those journeys with those couples. That's what
this
we did.
This is one of the things that actually blew me away about the couples that you interviewed. They revealed things and talked about hardship that brought them to tears and brought you to tears.
That's right.
And you gave them the option of saying, no, you don't have to talk about
this. That's right.
And they said that, no, we want to talk about this because we want young people to know what it's like and for them to have the information so that they can do better.
Well, that's exactly right. So, I mean, there was the deaths of children and even, you know, the murder of children. I actually got to hear in detail. It was very hard to hear, but it was also very cathartic for them to talk it through. And there were affairs, there were all sorts of things. I gave all of the couples the opportunity of using a pseudonym so they didn't have to use their own name, particularly those that had had affairs. And all of the couples except for three chose just to use their actual names. They said, no, we need to share this. We need to know that you can survive. We need young people to know you can survive affairs. You can survive, you know, the deaths of close family members. You can survive this. You can survive in-laws that are interfering. You can survive these things.
Yes.
And we want to show you how.
Yeah, so I'm just going to use that particular point to emphasize the difference of pathogenic studies and salutogenic studies, which is something that you brought up earlier.
Yeah.
We know, for example, that having an affair is the biggest risk factor for divorce. But these couples, some of them also had affairs, but the interesting thing is they survived it. And so we wanted to document what they did to survive affairs. And we were surprised how many affairs there were, because we know that at least 50% of couples who have affairs end up in divorce courts.
Yes.
But these were the couples that survived. And that's the salutogenic approach. It is seeing what goes right. And through that, we get to part three, which gives a whole lot of techniques in the book so that you can actually apply the science to your relationship so that your relationship can be resilient.
That's right. That's the last part of the book. Yeah. And obviously the book is for people that are struggling in their relationship, people that want to go deeper in their relationship, and also for couples therapists. And that's some of the techniques that come in there too.
Yeah. So it was primarily for couple therapists, because couple therapists, wonderful people. Thank you all the couple therapists out there.
Amazing work.
Dedicated to helping us have better relationships. But The emphasis of the evidence for couples therapists are on what goes wrong in a relationship, and the frameworks are all based on certain theories. Whereas here what we do is we put together more than 75 techniques so that couples therapists can use these techniques based on what goes right on a relationship. And I know that some of you relationship people out there know what goes right in a relationship. But we want that information to trickle down to people who are just starting their relationship journey or are looking to go into a relationship so that they can move forward in this very bewildering yet wonderful society to say, we can do it as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So we actually, what's really interesting about the techniques too is some of them are from the couples themselves. They you know, said what worked for them. And also the techniques are drawn from Christian's, you know, 20 years of psychiatry practice experience working with couples that have mental illness issues in
them. Yeah, that's right.
And also from the research in the book. So the book actually cites over 900 studies to back everything up that we've been talking about, obviously about hyper-individualism, socialization, plenty of information on the mental health crisis and stuff too.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So I'm going to go into a bit of a summary as to what we said today and what you can take away from this particular talk show, but also what you can expect in other talk shows. So what we've done, in a fun way, I hope, is introduce ourselves. Caroline as a theatre academic who has used her methodology to study what goes right in couples' relationships. And me as a clinical psychiatrist who has used my theory and clinical background to see what goes wrong in relationships, to bring those together to do this study because we saw that good relationships are fast becoming a thing of the past, but we want it to be a thing of the future. So to do that, we needed to document what went right in relationships.
And we actually even had one of the young people saying, look, there's so many forces in society that I don't know where to go with this. You know, they're putting pressure on my relationship to be one way or for me to break up. But how do I protect my relationship? How do I keep it safe from all of these external forces? And she actually used those words, putting too much pressure on the relationship.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm. There's a lot of pressures on a relationship. And I think that's the difference between people who had their relationship, let's say, started 50 years ago,
yeah,
or people whose relationship is starting now. 50 years ago, it was, why not have a relationship? Why aren't you getting married? Why aren't you getting into a long-term relationship? Whereas today, the question is, why do you want to get married? Why go into a long-term relationship? Take care of yourself.
Yeah.
So we will be presenting the science on that, which informed our book and all the other journals, and we'll be talking about other people's findings in that. Most importantly, we'll be talking about how to apply that science to your life. That's actually what the difficulty is.
Yes.
I kind of know the right thing to do. Just how do I get it going?
Yeah.
And look, we're in a relationship. We understand how difficult it is as well.
Yes. Okay.
And the stories. Because the story that isn't being told is that if you want to take care of yourself, if two people want to take care of themselves and do the most selfish thing for themselves so that they have the least amount of physical illness, the least amount of mental illness, the least amount of conflict in their life, and to have longevity in themselves, the most selfish thing they can actually do is take care of their relationship. So in other words, to have a good individual life, you need to be in a good individual relationship with another individual.
It seems like such a contradiction.
It does.
You know, that the hyper-individual way, the selfish way to go is actually to choose a long-term relationship, and you're actually most satisfied in yourself as well as obviously with your partner.
That's exactly right. And this is also based on the finding in our study that altruism is very
important.
Yes,
exactly.
That you need to be able to be a person that can give to somebody else, not just to yourself.
And what's really exciting about what we're going to be sharing in these talk shows is that Christian, of course, knows so much about the brain, and he will be able to talk to you about what's happening in the brain in couples and how even altruism works, and how that selfishness can can turn into togetherness, okay?
Yes.
And that you're so incredibly satisfied through that togetherness.
Yes, yes. So there's a lot.
There is a lot. We've got so much. And we will, of course, be looking at all these different journal articles, and we'll be pulling apart some of the things of commitment and altruism and shared values and our findings and what other people are finding about relationships in some really exciting research in couples therapy, some journal articles.
Yes, yes, it is. And being in a couple's relationship is a very exciting journey in itself. It has a few ups and downs,
but so does a roller coaster. Yeah, but that's all part of it. And as some of the couples said, adversity strengthens commitment.
So we'll be unpacking those sort of things in upcoming talk shows. And thank you for listening. And we are here, and we want to share this information because our society needs it, particularly the younger people.
It certainly does. So do join us in 2 weeks' time for another talk show where we will be unpacking more science, more application, more stories to help your relationship wherever it's at, whether it's just starting out, whether you're struggling, whether you're 50 years in and you just want to go deeper into your relationship and enhance it and learn to communicate better and just have that oneness that you're really craving.
So when is it, Caroline? Is it Friday nights?
It is. It will be Friday nights, always Friday nights, on the wonderful iHealth Radio channel, EMBC Network. So you can stream it live. We will have some podcasts that shoot off from this, so you can get it another time if you'd like, the Resilient Relationships Talk Show, but hosted by the wonderful Hurricane H on the iHealth Radio channel. Every Friday night, EST, so in New York time, we always call it New York time, at 9 p.m. And in Australia, for those that are following us in Australia, because we are Australian, AEDT time, it will be 11 a.m. On Saturday mornings. But we are looking so forward to your company and to help share this journey with you.
Okay, so just a reminder, it's every second Friday night.
Yes, that's right.
And we will see you or hear from you in a fortnight.
And thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next time. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Hey, fabulous listeners. We love getting reviews. We've said it before and we'll say it again. We really enjoy bringing you this podcast and we love hearing about it. So, for the month of March, if you do a review for A Magical Life, Health, Wealth and Weight Loss, you go into our competition, our draw for a $25 Amazon gift card. Yep, you heard it, $25 Amazon gift card. All you have to do is tell us what you think of the podcast, what episodes stand out to you, and we will pop you into our March 2023 draw, brought to you by Holistic Natural Health. Welcome to A Magical Life, Health, Wealth and Weight Loss. I'm your host, Magic Barclay, lead practitioner at Holistic Natural Health Australia and number one best-selling author. In this podcast, I aim to give you practical tips on how to accelerate and sustain your health, increase your financial, spiritual and emotional wealth, and to look at something that haunts many of us needlessly, weight loss. In some episodes, I'll have guests available to give you even more tips, but in others, the floor is yours. Drop us a line at A Magical Life Podcast on Facebook and let me know what you would like to know more about. Now, sit back and enjoy, because it is time for you to create and truly discover a magical life. Welcome back to A Magical Life. I'm your host, Magic Barclay, and today I'm joined by Kimberly Record. Kimberly is a self-sabotage expert, and we're going to learn more about her as this episode continues. Kim is the author of the women's self-help book, Finding Your Forever Body, which is a 10-step guide to breaking the diet cycle for good. She's the founder of the Self-Care Success Formula, which helps ambitious, purpose-driven women break self-sabotaging habits so they can regain their energy and confidence and create more joy and fulfillment in their lives by their own standards. Combining her background in holistic nutrition and high performance coaching, she empowers her clients to develop and stick to habits that support their health, vibrancy, and happiness without relying on their willpower. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you.
Now, tell us about finding your forever body.
It was a book that came from a passion. I had been doing nutrition consulting for about 6 years. And in that time,